people that really want to learn something serious, but I'm not here to entertain people that haven't got anything better to do. That's old style Rabbi Nachman that we haven't heard from her for a long time. Those kind, remember, Shirley, that was the kind of thing we would have expected from the Rebbe all those years ago. So I said, okay, so I said, but then it's going to be a sugya and something they can look it up if they want to, Minchas Chinuch, and it will be the sugya which, well, the Rebbe is going to introduce it, the transformative effect of hardship. So I said, okay, well, I'll just invite a couple of people and we'll see what happens. And then the next thing we got an I Awake an email. And then Michelle and I said to each other, now, are there going to be 5 people or 50 people? And we just didn't know how to actually structure the evening. So it looks like it was the latter. And we're very grateful. And I had no doubt that as soon as word gets out, that this is the kind of response we'll get. And I think that, Rabbi Lapin, it's obviously a tribute to you. Because it's just a couple of words that get out that Rabbi Lapin speaking and people flock. And I think virtually everybody sitting here remembers the Motzi Shabbos Shirim of old. I just asked Rabbi Lapin and he said it was a phenomenon that lasted for 22 years in this country, from 1975 until 1997. And there's no doubt that it touched the lives of thousands and thousands of people. I think we must have had at least 150 people at Keder Torah, and whoever you speak to remembers those wonderful Motzei Shabbos Shirim. And it was a very unpopular time. I don't know any Rabbonim that would have had the courage to actually have a shiur on a Motzei Shabbos, which was a time for people to go to movies and to relax after Shabbos, and yet they would come back for the shiur. And why did they come? Because it was transformative. Because people's lives changed. And that was the Torah that we were zoichet to, that we merited from Rabbi Lapin. So therefore, it was no surprise when Rabbi Lapin came out with a book called Leading by Greatness. Because I think all of us certainly felt that we were being led by a great human being that invested so much in himself along the school of the Musar, school of old, of Leta, transforming one's person, and also an incredible investment in other people. And I think many of us are very humbled by the amount of time that Rabbi Lapin invested in us. And I think that there are a lot of people in the world today, perhaps also thousands, that were transformed by the investment that Rabbi Lapin made. And I'm sure that there are many here that remember that sometimes the only time you could see the Rav was at midnight or 11 o'clock at night, and at the most obscure times, because he was running a business, had a family, lots of commitments, but would always make time to invest in others. So when you see the synthesis of business and Torah, you see that Torah was a business for Rabbi Lapin, and he chose to invest in people that themselves would become influential in a number of communities all over the world. So we thank you very much for giving of your time. Rabbi Lapin is only here for a week, from Wednesday to Wednesday. So you're here, and for our home, it's a great privilege for Michelle and I to host an occasion like this here. And if I may say that we're happy to do this more often. So when you're here, and you're here on a Motzi Shabbos, it'll be our pleasure to host you again. Welcome and thank you.
Thank you, Hugh and Michelle, and to you all. I feel a little bit bad that it's imposing, because when we talked originally, I thought a few of us would sit around the table and we would talk and learning a little bit. And that was what I pictured. And I'm certainly very honored and humbled that you all have found the time and given me the opportunity to reconnect with you. As I said at Keder Torah last night, I was going to open up and say I feel so at home here, and the same applies here in your home, but I don't say I feel at home, I say I am at home. And that's a wonderful feeling, and a wonderful feeling to reconnect with you. And that comment was not a flippant comment when I said to Hugh, It's not about entertaining people. I was speaking to a Rosh Hashiva a little while ago, and I said, "So, what's your angle? What do you do that other people don't do?" He says, "I entertain." He said, "People are bored. They go to shiurim, and they don't, and they're not entertained in the shiurim. So I entertain them. So that's where Torahs come to. Rosh Hashivas have become clowns, and that's what they see as part of their job. It's quite serious that." And it's not anything I ever wanted to do. And that was the reason. Sometimes people don't understand, and I spoke quite personally about it last night in Keder Torah. Some people don't understand And it's my fault. I've probably never explained it really. Why I did that. Why I did run a business. It's not as if I've made a whole lot of money out of running a business, but Baruch Hashem, being able to support a family and stay out of trouble, it's been, from that point of view, it's been a great schus, but it's not, you can't make a whole lot of money in a business if half your time your head is in Torah. When building a base of medrash or preparing a shiur, it doesn't work that way. Unless you start off with a whole lot of money, then you can do it, but you can't start it. That was never the, my intention was never to make more money out of business than Torah. In fact, as I said to Rabbi Rappaport last night, three times in my life I've been offered jobs in Rabbonis where the salary was far more than I was earning in business. So it was never about money. It was about not having to teach Torah to people who didn't want to learn it. Because if Torah is your business, you need customers. If you're being paid to teach, you need students. And then you start doing whatever you need to do to attract students. Even being a clown, if that's what they want you to be. They want entertaining, then you'll be entertaining. You'll do whatever they want. And I just never wanted to do that. And that was based on a Gemara in Tainis. Last night I explained a whole lot of other chazals that were responsible for what I'm doing, particularly at the moment. But the general idea of not wanting to earn money from Torah, it's not because of the whole halachic question of whether you're allowed to earn money from Torah or not. That wasn't the issue. It was just for the sake of that independence. The Gemara says in Daf Zayin and Tainis, Omer Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, Lama nimshulu divrei Torah ke'etz? Shenemar etz chaim hi lamachazikim ba. Why is the Torah compared to wood? Etz chaim, normally we say etz chaim, we think of it as a tree of life. But etz also means wood. And the Gemara here is learning, etz chaim, the Torah is the wood of life. Why is it wood? So the Gemara explains, Ba'aloy malachot comes to teach you, ma etz koton madlik es hagodol. If you've got a big thick plank or a big thick log and you want to light a fire, how do you light it? You use small little pieces of wood. You light them first. And from the small little pieces you build a fire and that sets the big one alight. In the same way, af tamidei chachomim ktanim mechadedim es hagadolim. If a great Talmid Chacham wants to stay sharp, he should have young Talmidim who are starting off. Because Talmidim who are starting off ask questions that nobody else asks, they see things that nobody else sees. And that was part of the wonder of that period of time in Johannesburg, going back to the 70s and 80s, with the start of the Baal Tshuva movement here, and my schus in being able to be involved in that, and from all of you who were part of that, I learned so much. Because of the questions that you asked and the angles that you had, and still do. Behind it, Omar Rabbi Chanina, the Gemara says, Harbei lomadati mirabeisar mechaveiro yosem mirabeisar. I've learned a lot from my rabbein and from my chaverim. I've learned more. Umitalmida yosem ikulon. And from my students, I've learned more than anybody. And then the Gemara goes on, Rabbi Chanina bar Papa Rami. Rabbi Chanina bar Papa asks a question. And this is a fundamental principle in Torah education. Used to be a fundamental principle in Torah education. Ksiv. The two contradictory psukim. Likras tsome heitoyu mayim. Bear water. Tilt your water towards a thirsty person. Carry your water to a thirsty person. And in mayim el Torah, it's clearly talking about Torah. Take your Torah to people who are thirsty. On the other hand, it also says, let any thirsty person go to get water. So on who is the onus? Is the onus on the Baal HaMayim, the person who has the water, to go out and serve it? Or is the onus on the person who wants the water to go out and seek it? That's the question of the Gemara. Answers the Gemara, it depends. In Talmid Hogunhu, Likrat Tzome Hitoyu Mayim. If the Talmud is Hogun, Hogun normally means appropriate. What does appropriate mean? Rashi explains. In Talmud Chacham, Hogun, Sheroitze Lilmoid Mimcha. It means aligned. If a Talmud is aligned with you and wants to learn Mimcha from you, Mitzvah L'Rav Leilech Etzlo Bimkoim. then the Rav has to go wherever the Talmud is, and he has to make himself available. Ve'iloi, and if he's not a Talmud Hogan, have he called some elechu l'mayim? What does it mean if he's not a Talmud Hogan? It doesn't mean he's a bad guy. It just means that he doesn't need to learn from you. And if he doesn't want to learn from you, then he should go to the Rav. So what does Rashi mean? We've just said he doesn't want to learn from you, so why is he going to go? It's kind of counterintuitive. If he wants to learn from you, then you, the Rav, have to go to him. If he doesn't want to learn from you, then he can come to you. But he's not going to come to you, he doesn't want to learn from you. So the answer is he doesn't care who he learns from. I'm not talking about somebody who doesn't want to learn at all. It's a, if it makes no difference who you're learning from, then the Rav doesn't have to make himself available. You go and find yourself a Rav. It doesn't have to be me. And this was a psak lemaisa when I spoke to Rav Meir Soloveitchik about a situation that I was in at the same time, going to a certain city, spending time there. To what extent did he feel that I had to make myself available for learning? And he took out this Gemara. And he said, it depends on the time. If there are people who want to learn specifically from you, you have to make yourself available. If they don't, you don't have a chiyuv. You can sit and learn quietly by yourself. And so that's, I used this Gemara in my mind, although we didn't discuss the Gemaras, the emails, we were both in a hurry at the time. But when Hugh said, how about a shirim, what's a Shabbos? I said, only if there's an appetite. I didn't mean an appetite for learning Torah. I know in Johannesburg there's a great appetite for learning Torah, and that's wonderful. But I don't have to give up a Mitzvah Shabbos if people don't care where they're learning or who they're learning. If there's an appetite, sure. So I thought we would have five or six people around the table. So I must assume it's when you open your house. I don't think this is me, because I've done it before sometimes, and it is. I think you open your house on a Mitzvah Shabbos, and everybody wants to come and join you. So I think it says a whole lot for Hugh and Michelle. And thank you very much for that. So we all begin to learn the serious Gemara, and then we'll try and extract some principles from it. And I couldn't have chosen a more morbid subject, so it's so far from entertaining. It's totally morbid. But we'll cheer it up at the end. It's quite interesting. Maybe I'll start off asking you a question. I have a client. I don't know how my clients are very strange. Who I land up as clients? It's like in Rotsa Lilmoid Bin Chavay, kind of the people who want you. They're the people you land up working with. And one of my clients is a wonderful client, wonderful people with great values. And the first unusual thing about them is that they're American Indians. And the second unusual thing about them is that they're a casino. They're not only a casino, but one of their big businesses is a casino. And they're amazing human beings. In fact, the reason they contacted me originally is they were a very, very poor Indian tribe in Alabama. And had decided to build this casino, and they asked us to do two things. The one was to help them design and construct the people engineering, which was really very sophisticated when you think of that. They said, we're building from scratch. We've got an opportunity. So we're going to build a world-class casino and a world-class hotel and a world-class spa. But you can't do that if you don't have world-class people. So while we're busy building the structure, would you help us build the people? That's the one thing. The second thing, they said, we know we're going to become very wealthy very quickly, and we're afraid we're going to lose our values and our spirituality. Can you build in the systems to make sure that that will never happen? Interesting thing. You learn how much one learns from clients, from posher to people. These are uneducated. Very few of them have an education. Some of them do, but most of them don't. But there's just an elegite about them. It's just amazing, amazing experience that's been working with them. But the reason I raise this is, would you say that a casino offers anything of value to its customers? And if so, what? Other than entertainment. But if it's entertainment, then the movies do as well. So, and that's safer. At the end of the day, it costs less to get your entertainment at a movie than it does at a casino. So the first question is, does a casino offer anything to its customers? And the second thing is, what?
Hope.
Interesting, hope. And we'll see, does that have value in a Torah, structure, in a Torah world? What is the value of hope, and where does it fit in, and why is it important? So the Gemara says the following. There's an interesting question. In Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Hei Amud Beis, Ritzicho Gufo Tidoche Es HaShabbos Mikal V'Chomer. The Gemara asks, murder should push aside Shabbos. It doesn't mean murder like criminal murder. It's not talking about South Africa. It's talking about Yerushalayim. So what murder is it talking about that should put aside Shabbos? The death sentence. If there's a need to kill somebody, that's a mitzvah d'oraisa. If the person is found guilty of death, then it's a mitzvah to kill the person. And you should be able to do that even on Shabbos, using a kal v'chomer. What's the kal v'chomer? Mo avoido shedoicha es haShabbos. What about avoidas beis hamikdash? Are you allowed to light fires in the beis hamikdash? Yes. Are you allowed to shecht animals in the beis hamikdash? Yes, even on Shabbos. Why? Because avoida pushes Shabbos aside. That's the first principle. Avoida, the temple service, pushes the restrictions of Shabbos aside. Ritzicha doicha oiso, murder, in other words, execution, pushes aside avoida. Shene'emar me'im mizbechi tikochenu lamus. There's a pasuk in Shmos that says, even if a person, a kohen, is busy doing the avoida, he's busy with temple service, if he's guilty of a capital offense, you can take him away in the middle of his temple service. As long as he's not really at the Mizbeach, busy at the Mizbeach, if he's doing anything else on the temple service, you can take him away and cart him off and execute him. You don't say finish the temple service first. You can interrupt it. So, Ritzicho, execution for capital offense, pushes aside temple service. In that case, the Gemara says, Shabbos shenidches mipnei avoido. Shabbos gets pushed aside by avoido, and avoido gets pushed aside by execution. In the din sheteirut zichadoicha esos, so certainly executions should put aside Shabbos. So, which, if you just look in terms of hierarchy, which is more important? So, avoido is more important than Shabbos, than the laws of Shabbos, than the restrictions of Shabbos. And what's more important, avoido or ritzicha? Execution. Execution pushes aside avoida. Avoida pushes aside Shabbos. So clearly, execution should push aside Shabbos. And if somebody is guilty of a capital offense, you should be able to execute him on Shabbos. And do you think this is a very relevant discussion? It's not. Certainly not today. And even at that time, it didn't happen very often. That what the Gemara says, that even if an execution happened once in 70 years, that was unusual and considered violent. The executions were very, very rare, and the possibility of an execution of Shabbos, so who's ever heard of such a thing? But the Gemara talks about it, and we'll see why. Omar Rava says, Rava, kfar posko tana debe Rabbi Yishmoel. That's already been decided by tana debe Rabbi Yishmoel. An interesting theoretical question you're asking, that using the kal v'chomer we should push aside Shabbos in favor of an execution. But we have a tana debe Rabbi Yishmoel. The tana debe Rabbi Yishmoel, loy tevaru esh. There's a posuk which happens to be in this week's Sedra. You shall not light fires on Shabbos. Mot Talmud Lomar, what does that mean? So it says the Gemara, Mot Talmud Lomar, what do you mean? The Gemara gives all sorts of things as to what it could mean. No, says the Gemara. Meshoves dichtiv rachmon alamani. It says, Bechol Moshveh Sechem, you should not light a fire in any of your settlements. And normally, when it says Moshveh Sechem in the Torah, it comes to teach you that that law about which it says Moshveh Sechem applies both in Israel and in Chutz La'aretz. In this case, says the Gemara, we already know that it should apply here, that the execution law should apply anywhere. It's not tied to Eretz Israel. It's not a law of the land. It's not agricultural. It's not dependent on the land. And therefore we know that you should be able to fire, not the law of execution, but the law of making a fire, it should apply everywhere. So why does the Torah say, you shall not light fires, bechol moshveh seichem, which means everywhere in the world. You shouldn't light a fire on Shabbos anywhere in the world. Of course you can't light a Shabbos, you can't light a fire anywhere in the world. We know that. There's no havamina to say, there's no assumption, there's no reason to think for a moment that the issur of lighting a fire should apply only in Israel, not in Chutz La'aretz. There's no reason for that. So why does it say Bechol Moshveh Sechem? So it comes to teach you a different thing altogether. And what it comes to teach you is that this applies to Beis Din. And lo tevaru esh b'chol moshvei seichem, you shall not burn a fire anywhere in your settlements, means sreifa. Sreifa is one of the four capital punishments. So there's herig, and there's cherib, and there's skila, and there's sreifa. They used to execute people in four different ways. One was by stoning, and one was by strangulation, and one was by sword, by guillotine, and one was by sreifa. And sreifa didn't mean that you were thrown into a fire. There were all sorts of not very pleasant ways of doing it. But it was an act of burning. You burnt the inside of the person, and they died from that. And that's what it means. Now, you learned the parasha today. Is that how you understood it? Oh, I get it. You're not allowed to execute people on Shabbos. That's what it means. Where do you get that from? And if that's what you want to say, why not say it? And the Gemara learns it. Tosfos brings, it doesn't only mean sreifa, it means any form of death. And a Beis Din is not allowed to execute on Shabbos. That's what it means. So let's just understand, we'll go into the whys and where does it come from and why is it written that way in a little while. But firstly, let's just go into the process, into the technology of this piece of learning. So the Gemara starts off saying, you should be able to execute people on Shabbos because of a Kal Vachomer. And then the Gemara says, no, you're right, that should be the case, but there's a posuk in our parasha that precludes that. And because of all complicated thing, that's how we interpret the posuk. So this basically is, it says, if there's a posuk that says, you may not execute somebody on Shabbos. And that the reason that posuk is there is because without that posuk, you would have assumed that you could execute on somebody on Shabbos because of the Kal Vachomer. So it comes to tell you that you can't. So now I want to ask you the following question. How do you understand the Gemara? Now that we know you may not execute somebody, let's talk about sreifa, because that's the simple one. You may not burn somebody as a form of capital punishment. What is that issue? Is that one of the Lamed Tes Melachos? How do you understand that in the Gemara? Those of you familiar with the workings of Shabbos and the Lamed Tes Melachos, there are 39 Melachos you're not allowed to do. The Gemara comes along and says you should be able to execute, even though it's a Melacha, you should be able to execute because of a Kal Vachomer. Comes the Gemara and says, no, there's a posuk that says, forget the Kal Vachomer. So what does that do with the din? Does that push it back into the Lamed Tes Melachos? Or is it a separate issue? How do you understand the logic of the Gemara? Anyone? It would seem to be pushing it back into the Lamed Tes Melachos, because the Havamina is that this should be pushed aside because of the Kal Vachomer. So we say, no, forget the Kal Vachomer. There's a posuk that teaches you the Kal Vachomer doesn't apply. So you left us where you were before the first assumption. You just go back, you loop back to the beginning, you remove the Kal Vachomer, and now you've got an Isra Shabbos. It's one of the 39 things you go over on Shabbos and finish. If that's the case, and Mr. Gochen is right, then why does the Sefer HaChinuch and others count it as a mitzvah on its own? Mitzvah Shin Lamed Aleph, 331. Mitzvah Kuf Yudalet, 114. Shelo Yasu Beis Din Mishpat Mavit B'Shabbos. Beis Din is not allowed to execute on Shabbos. What does that tell us? That this is a new issue. It's not part of the 39. It's not part of the 39 Melachos. This is something different. This is something separate. So why do we need it? There's already an issue. We already know you can't kill people. You can't even kill an animal on Shabbos. It's Netilas Neshama. You can't kill people. You can't make fires. You can't burn people or things or anything. We know that already. Why do we have to be told that it's an additional melacha? That it's additional issue. That in addition to the 39 melachas, there's now another one. Beis Din can't execute on Shabbos. Why doesn't it simply put it back into the category? And we would know you can't execute because it's one of the 39 Melachos. What are we meant to learn from this? The other thing that's interesting is if it is one of the Melachos, and some hold that it is one of the Melachos, then we have an interesting idea that a Melacha on Shabbos, the things you're not allowed to do on Shabbos, have to be Meleches Machsheves. And Meleches Machsheves is a term that appears also in our parasha today. and it appears in the work that Bezalel and his crew did for the Mishkan. That was called Melechus Machsheves. And since we learn the Surah Shabbos, the prohibitions of Shabbos are learned from the Mishkan, we learn that Melechus Machsheves applies by Surah Shabbos as well. What does Melechus Machsheves mean? Unculus says, and I don't remember the exact words of Unculus, the formation of the words, but it's, the word is Avoidaso de Umnavin, which means a work of art. So the work of the Mishkan was all works of art, which means what's forbidden on Shabbos are works of art. Everything you're not allowed to do on Shabbos, there's an artistic element to it. And one can go through all the Surah Shabbos and understand what artistic element there is in each of them. Each of them is still one can understand. What about execution? Where's the artistic element in execution? So if we say it's a separate Isur, it's not one of the Lamed Tes Melachos, and it's not learned from the Mishkan, it's learned from a separate place, then it doesn't have to be artistic. Not a problem. But if it is one of the Lamed Tes Melachos, as many of the Rishonim hold, then it does have to be a work of art. Where's the work of art? So Tosfos explains the work of art. What is a work of art means that in your action, you're creating something new and something beautiful. And we see that with all the 39 Melachos. So what are you creating that is so beautiful when you execute somebody? Says Tosfos, you're creating kapora, you're creating atonement. You're releasing the soul. Now that's quite hard for us. We look at execution, and because we are so secular in our mindsets, we see execution as termination, the termination of life. We don't look at it and say, this is the creation of a future for a person who would otherwise have no Olam Haba. That's what execution is. Execution is not that anybody wants it upon themselves, but if, God forbid, somebody has done something that is of capital nature, somebody's done a capital offense, that's an unbelievable chesed. That Hashem says, even a capital offense, there is a way you can cleanse yourself and reach atonement to the point where you can go to Olam Haba as a tzaddik. A murderer can go to Olam Haba as a tzaddik. There's a vehicle. Now, for a human being who lives spiritually, what do you think he says? Well, how would he respond if we said to him, you know, you have a choice. We can let you go free, and there's no Olam Haba, and your soul is finished. You're living without a soul. Or we can cleanse you, we can cleanse the soul by destroying the body. What do you want? Any Baal Nefesh would say, well, sure, take the body. I'm not living for my body. I'm living for my spirit. So we find it all so difficult because of the way we conceive of these things. But if one lives spiritually, then the ultimate destruction of ego is death. Because as long as a human being is alive, there's some ego. And one needs some ego. Ego is Yetzirah. And one needs Yetzirah. One needs ego. Gemara says, without that, people wouldn't build businesses, and they wouldn't build homes, and they wouldn't build families. They wouldn't do anything. They would sit under trees in the Himalayas and meditate. You need ego, but the ego needs to be controlled. So a person who's performed a capital offense has allowed his ego to corrupt. The ego is corrupted. So imagine that you've got a computer with a corrupted virus, and it's a mess, and every document you open you can't read, and the computer professional says to you, look, I can fix your computer, but you're going to lose all the memory. But then it'll be clean, then you'll have a new computer, but I can't salvage the memory. You say, if that's the only way, fine. And he cleans it up, and you start with a clean slate. That's a death sentence. The body has become so corrupt, the ego has become so corrupted, that it can only be, the whole being can only be saved if the ego is erased. That's what the death sentence is. And if you see it that way, then execution becomes a work of art. Because it's the creation of kapora. When I said, part of what I was interested in speaking about was this idea of the transformative power of hardship. That's an extreme case of execution. But any hardship deletes some of the ego. That's why as people go through life, particularly if they've experienced hardship and suffering, their ego becomes more and more under control. And if you learn the lot, that the piece in Pirkei Avos that tracks through a lifetime starting with 5 years, but listen, 10 years, and 10, 15, and 20, and so on, all the way up to 90 and 100. You actually watch the development of the human being becoming spiritually greater as the ego becomes weaker. That's the passage of life. The first part of life, the ego builds, and we use it for all sorts of good things, and then the ego deteriorates, and the spirit builds. So any form of hardship, any form of suffering, any form of pain can be used to elevate the spiritual. If you're aware of it and you focus and you're able to take that instead of trying to escape the suffering all the time. Again, it's not our way in Torah to want suffering or to seek suffering. Not at all, ever, other than fast days. But even a fast day is that. If you look at the Tefillah Zakov of Yom Kippur, even fast day is a mini death. It's the killing of part of the ego. And any form of hardship and suffering is killing part of the ego. And if you just focus on the killing piece, then it becomes destructive and negative and depressing. But if you're able to focus on it and understand how through that you can actually release yourself and liberate yourself and reduce the ego, then there is a very transformative power in that hardship. And that's the meaning of this being a maleches machsheves, if we say it's a malocha altogether. And they use that, by the way, they use that in that technique in pain management. The medical center at the University of Boston has a pain management center, mainly for cancer patients, where they use the focus on the spiritual as a way to diffuse attention from the pain. And they can get to points where you actually don't feel the pain. That's the level in which you can move your focus from the spiritual, which is the negative part of you, from the physical, to the spiritual. And you've seen these things of walking on fire that Tony Robbins and other people do. That's all it is. It's just being able to focus your mind away from what could be very hurtful into something liberating and positive and uplifting. And if you can move your mind from the body to the spirit, from the suffering to the freedom, from the hardship to the transformation, you actually don't feel the hardship. It's an amazing force and a power of physical pain management and emotional pain management, and it's a reality in terms of how it all works. But let's get back to the view that this is a mitzvah on its own. What is the nature of this mitzvah and what is it for? So it's quite interesting that the Gemara before this goes into a set of sequences that result from this halacha. And it's the implications of the halacha that are important. It's not the fact you can't execute on Shabbos. It's some interesting implications. If you can't execute on Shabbos, then there's a whole lot of chain reactions that are important. What are some of those chain reactions? The chain reaction is, Lefichach, the Rambam says, in the 11th parak of Sanhedrin, Ein danin dinei nefoshes lo erev Shabbos ve lo erev Yom Tov. You can't judge capital offenses on Friday or Erev Yom Tov. Now, capital offenses used to get judged quite quickly. It's not like here, it goes on and on and on. It used to be judged in a day, maximum 2 days. If the first day they couldn't prove guilt, the guy who's been accused. The perpetrator, the accused, goes free. If sunset comes and they can't prove his guilt, he goes free. So we don't keep him in court longer than a day. Unless he's been found guilty, then we ask the judges to go to sleep on it and reconsider the next day, because maybe the next day they'll find some reason to let him off. So it works both ways in the accused's favor. If he hasn't been found guilty by sunset, the case is closed. If he has been found guilty by sunset, it's reopened the next day, and then it has to be finished that day. We also have a din that once he's found guilty, he must be immediately executed. There's no delay between the conviction and the execution. So now we're not allowed to execute on Shabbos. So what happens if you have a court case on Friday? If he's found innocent, it's no problem. He can go free. But if he is not found innocent, if he's found guilty, you have to continue on Shabbos. And if you continue on Shabbos and you find him guilty on Shabbos, then what do you have to do? Execute him on Shabbos. But you can't execute him on Shabbos. So what does this halacha really teach us? Not that you can't execute him on Shabbos. That we can figure out from the 39 halachas. What this really comes to teach us is that you can't have a judgment on Friday or Shabbos. You can't even consider the case on Friday and Shabbos. That being the case, we've got to look at why not. What's the reason for that? And what do we do? So the reason for that, the Sefer HaChinuch writes the reason for that. And he says, Mishor Sheh HaMitzvah, the reason for this mitzvah, is Sherotso Hashem Yisborech L'chabed Hayom Hazeh. Hashem wanted Shabbos to be an honored day. Sheyimtzu Uboi Menucho Hakol, that everybody can find peace and rest on Shabbos. Gam hachotim v'hachayovim, even guilty people, even people who are awaiting trial for a capital offense, must be able to enjoy Shabbos. That's what he gives us as the reason. So what do we do with a person? What do we do with him if we find that we capture him on his, committed a murder or whatever, we capture him on Thursday or Friday, what do we do with him? Says the Rambam. You put him into jail, you lock him up, and you have the case on Sunday. The Gemara says you can't start the case on Friday and finish it on Sunday. And the reason for that is very interesting too. The reason is because the Dayonim forget the nuances of the case. And the Gemara says that it's all recorded, it's all written down. And the Gemara says you can only write down facts, but you feel nuances. And a day later, they're gone. Hasn't that happened to you often? Like you haven't written something down properly, or you haven't. It's very hard to recapture the way you're feeling about a situation. And the notes can communicate information and facts, but it can't communicate feeling. And feeling is part of the Dayonus process. Part of the way you judge is by the way you feel about it. There is a level of subjectivity in judgment. There isn't subjectivity in evidence, but there is subjectivity in judgment. And you lose that feeling of the case if you hold it on. So the only thing you can do, says the Rambam, if you catch him on Friday, you've got to put him in jail on Friday and try him on Sunday. So now let's look at the psychology. So you're not allowed to start him on Friday because you might have to finish him on Shabbos. So let's say you finish him on Shabbos and you leave him till Sunday for execution. Why is that so terrible? Because he's got to enjoy the Shabbos. And locking him up in jail and telling him we'll try you for murder on Sunday, what kind of Shabbos is he going to have there? So what you see is, being in jail with hope is more restful than being in the Westcliff Hotel with no hope. If there's a choice, is the Sefer HaChinuch, what is the reason? The reason is because he must have a good Shabbos. Even he must have a good Shabbos. So now let's look at the technicality of it. The technicality is, you can't start his trial and not finish it, because there's a loss of hope. He sees how the trial's going. But before the trial starts, he thinks there's a chance I'll get off. There won't be the proper evidence. Who knows what will be. The cross-examination will fail. He knows there's hope. And he has to have hope on Shabbos. Doesn't that say he has to be in the Westcliff Hotel or in the Saint and Son Hotel? It doesn't say that. That's not what makes Shabbos, what gives menucha on Shabbos. You don't find peace of mind because of your environment. You don't find peace of mind because of your comfort. You don't find peace of mind because of your wealth. And anybody who deals with people knows that. There are many wealthy people who have no peace of mind. There are many comfortable people who have no peace of mind. There are very many people who live in luxurious environments who have no peace of mind. What gives peace of mind? Hope. the ability, the optimism, the ability to see a possible future, even if it's a small possibility. That's the power of hope. And hope plays a part in Shabbos. On Shabbos, part of what we need to do in Shabbos is plug into our hope. Because during the week, sometimes we get involved and we don't have a chance to look into the future. We don't have a chance to envision the nachas we can get from our children and from our grandchildren in the future. The fact that one can have a pleasant life. The fact that there can be all sorts of opportunities in the future. What are the chances? Maybe they're small chances. Doesn't matter. Hope is not about statistics. As anybody who's worked with a casino knows, what are the statistical chances that you'll beat the casino? They're zero. So what's the hope? You might just win tonight. And that hope is terribly important for people. And that's why very often in casinos, apart from the professional gamblers, you see people never who don't have a whole lot of hope in their life. Their lives are difficult, and people say, look at it, it's terrible, look at it, it's attracting the people. Of course, those are the people who need it. And it's quite interesting, in this particular casino, how carefully they monitor people not to let them spend too much. That they're happy if they come and spend $50, and they come once a week, or once every 2 weeks, that's okay. But they don't want to build their business on people coming and offloading their wealth and being devastated afterwards. Because they understand they're selling hope, they're not selling... That's what they want to give people. And they adjust their machines in such a way that there's a fairly, in casino statistics, a reasonable chance compared to their competition. They give away more than others do because they're selling hope. And they want people to know and to hear that it's possible. I was doing a workshop with one of their teams just a few days ago. It was their government. Because an Indian tribe in the United States operates almost like a little sovereign country. They're not bound to the laws of the state. They deal directly with the federal government. And they're very independent. That's constitutionally entrenched. They can make their own laws. They've got their own police force. They've got their own legislature. They function like a little country. So we were working with the government of this particular tribe of people. And there was a woman there who has an ordinary job in the government. And I felt quite sorry for her, and I was listening to her. And then somebody came up to me and said, "Don't feel sorry for her. She won $6,000 last night." And I said, "That's nothing. She wins a lot." So it's not that unusual in that particular casino. People win and people hear about it, and that's what they want. They want the hope. Because hope allows for optimism, and optimism is the most important ingredient for menuchas nefesh. When people want menuchas nefesh, it doesn't help going on holiday on vacation. If you don't have hope, if you've just lost your job and you go on vacation, it's not going to be much of a vacation. You're not going to be refreshed. Unless you have some ideas already, there's hope. So if you want to help somebody relax, the thing to do is to focus them on hope, on the level of possibility. That's what this halacha is talking about. So it looks like a very technical, rather morbid halacha about execution. But when you unravel it and you see that's not really what it comes to teach. It comes to teach the ingredients of menucha, the ingredients of Shabbos. So we know the normal ingredients of Shabbos, kiddush, and not doing the malachas, and not going to work. We know the normal ingredients. But there's an additional ingredient to Shabbos that we often don't learn about. And that is to focus on Shabbos, to focus on hope. On Shabbos, to focus on optimism. To be able to see through, and if you look at the Zemiris of Shabbos, you'll see how they all show... deal with, even in times of hardship, focus on the outcome, focus on getting beyond it, focus on the geula, focus on getting through it and seeing the hope and seeing the possibilities out there in the future. That's what we need to do. That's part of the Shabbos Avodah. And we're not allowed to take an individual, even a criminal, and put him in a situation where for one Shabbos of his life he doesn't have hope. We're not allowed to do that. And even if there's a chance that he escapes, rather that than deprive a Jew of Shabbos. And deprive a Jew of Shabbos doesn't mean Kiddush. He can make Kiddush. Doesn't mean that he won't be able to keep the Shabbos and not do any of the malachas. He can do that. He can be 100% frum. And it's still no Shabbos. Because he doesn't have hope. And to deprive another person of hope is litavah reish. That's destroying somebody. To private Navesh. So what does it emerge then? It emerges then that it's not only that you can't execute the person on Shabbos, you can't even judge him on Shabbos. And what would you say if it's not about a death sentence? What about even if it's Malkus? Says the Rambam, and everybody questions the Rambam, but it's clear. Says the Rambam, Malkus, the 39 whippings, lashings that a person gets for certain things, is the same. You can't give that to them on Shabbos, but that's not the chiddush. The chiddush is you can't put them in a situation where they know for sure that that's the punishment they're going to get, any punishment. You can't deprive a person of the hope of being able to get through a situation unscathed, of being able to come out of at the other end. That's the power of hope. And we need to bring that into our Shabbos, especially when things are hard. If a person's going through a hard time or a family's going through a hard time, Shabbos is not just a time to escape and not think about the hardship. It's more than that. It's to think about the positive outcomes when you get through it. That it's possible to get through. We eventually get through hardship. And to be able to see through that and understand that and attach one's hope onto that becomes very, very important. The final thing that's interesting is, what about where do you see it in the words? Lo tabayru esh b'chol mosh v'sechem, that you can't burn fire in any of your in any of your places of living or of residence. Where do we see in that this is talking about execution? That's interesting that the word Eish, Aleph Shin, is really the root of humanity. Ish and Isho, the root is Aleph Shin. The root is not Aleph Yud Shin, because an Isho doesn't have a Yud. And it's not Aleph Shin Hei, because an Ish doesn't have a Hei. So the root of humanity, of a human being, is Aleph Shin. And Aleph Shin is Eish as well. So lo tavayru esh means, if you know how to take it with a little bit of drush, lo tavayru esh means don't burn people. That's what it says. So you can, but pashtis, the pshat of it is lo tavayru esh, you don't make a fire, and that means sofa, but bederech drush, lo tavayru esh, don't burn people on Shabbos. And the way we've learned that now, what is burning a person? Taking away their hope is burning a person. That's destroying a person. Don't burn people, particularly on Shabbos. That doesn't mean you're allowed to burn them when it's not Shabbos. If it's an execution, if it's a psak beis din, you can. But if it's not a psak beis din, you can never do that. Never remove somebody's hope. Because that's so destructive to a person. And when you give somebody hope, what are you doing? You're giving them life. You're putting out the fire. And so often we find people who've just in a temporary stage of their lives, sometimes more than that, they've lost hope. And to give somebody hope is a mechayim esim. It's revival of a dead person. Because you can't live without hope. And it goes a little bit further. That there's a pasuk in Vayikra, Eish tukad ala mizbeach loy techabe. You've got to put a fire onto the mizbeach and not extinguish it. It must never be extinguished. The old Lubavitcher Rebbe writes an explanation on that which is so beautiful. And this is also with the drush. It's not the pshat of the pasuk, of course, but he says Eish, the mizbeach then is a place where you sacrifice. And odom ki yokriv michem, the idea of sacrifice is you're sacrificing something of yourself. So although, for example, today there are no sacrifices as such, but the principles of sacrifice apply just the same. All the yisodos, all the principles of sacrifice apply, because we sacrifice ourselves for things that are bigger than us. We do that all the time, and that's an important part of our lives, is to be willing to sacrifice ourselves for things that are more important than us. One of the most in the book, Lead by Greatness, and I'm sorry I don't have copies available here, but they're on Amazon, and there's Kindle version on Amazon. One of the important parts of it is the part that I call there the two operating systems, where I explain something very posh that as far as I know, the world of sociology and psychology has never dealt with. The question was asked by Charles Darwin. The question was, why do people do things that aren't in their interests? Why do people do heroic things? And he offered a kind of a solution that it's because, it doesn't do anything for, because his whole thing is survival of the species, the survival of the fittest. People do things to survive. But then why do people give their lives for others? And not only for family members, people give their lives for strangers. You see it all the time in the newspaper. The news people are doing that. They're not even professionals who pay to do that, like the police and military people. Ordinary people do that. And they make sacrifices and they do things and they give tzedakah without any expectation of anything back. Why are they doing it? It doesn't. Darwin's philosophy and methodology doesn't explain heroics. And then they say because it, for the species it's good, and that's been rejected. Darwin himself said it wasn't he wasn't satisfied with it, and nobody's been able to explain it as far as I know. And what I explain indeed by greatness is that human beings, unlike animals, have two operating systems. We actually have two different ways of operating. And the one is instinctual, and that's very similar to the animals. And most of the study of human behavior is the study of the instinctual operating system. And the whole Darwin thing is that survival of the fittest is instinctual. Animals do it, humans do it. And when they do experiments on animals and they apply it to human beings, they're checking the instinctual operating system. But we have another operating system called the heroic operating system, where we find security by making a contribution, which is very different, because the instinctual operating system, you get security by grabbing and taking and keeping and holding. That's what you do, preserving. In the heroic operating system, you get security by giving. Now, in business, this is a very easily understood concept. It's so interesting that in business we get it, and in all other social sciences, they haven't got it yet. How does a business make a living? By doing something for people that others can't do. That's how you do it. And the better you do that, the more secure you are as a business. The moment you're not doing something for people that others can't do, you don't survive as a business. And humans are the same. That's the heroic operating system. If we feel we're making a contribution, if we feel we're changing the world, then we feel secure. We feel safe. People need us. People value us. People will pay us. I have a job because I have an ability to do something for other people, which is valuable. It's quite interesting. I often explain to my clients, unpack a conversation that happens with little five-year-old kids and their dads very often, where the little kid says, when I grow up, I want to be a fireman. Do you call them firemen here still?
Yes.
In America, you're not allowed to say that because it's anti-feminist and so on. You've got to say a firefighter. So he says, I want to be a fireman if he's in South Africa, or a firefighter if he's in the United States. So what is the father likely to say? If he's engaged. Sorry? What sort of job is that for a Jewish kid? I mean, that's not. How about going to university, getting a degree, become an engineer, become an accountant? If you still want to be a firefighter after that, that's fine, but at least you've got a profession. So what's actually happened in that conversation? Let's unpack it. What did the kid mean when he said, I want to be a fireman? Did he mean, I've done a study of professions, and I've done an analysis of net present value of all future earnings, and I figure that considering the investments in education, the greatest returns come from firefighting. Is that what he means? No, that's not what he means. So what does he mean?
I want to wear the clothes.
I want to?
Wear the clothes.
I want to be a hero. I want to save people. I want to be the guy that when everybody walks down the street, everybody's happy to see. That's what he's saying. So now let's play the conversation a little differently. What happens if the father then says, well, that's great. That's fantastic. I love that idea. Clearly, you want to make a difference and you want to be. Is that right? Why do you want to be a firefighter? Let's look at, are there other things you could do that would be as heroic? You could be a physician. You could be a cardiologist. You could. Are there other things you can do? Let's have a look at it and you start. Now, when the father takes the first route, what has actually happened? Child has said, I want to make a difference in the world. Father has said, that's not what life is about. Life is about what you can get from the world. And that programs the child for the rest of its life. And what we have to do then in the kind of education that we do, whether it's in Torah or it's in the kind of work that I do in business, is to unprogram that. Get back to being a firefighter. Because that's your tachlis. Your tachlis is not to make money. Your tachlis is, money is the outcome. If you put out fires, you know what? There are fire agencies, firefighting agencies, who will hire you. And they will pay you. And if you save people's lives, you'll get rewards for it. You don't have to worry about that. You go back to being the firefighter. Go back to making the difference. And that's what Lead by Greatness is about. How do you do that? How do you work out what your purpose is? How How do you work out whether you were designed and built to be a firefighter or a school teacher or a nurse or an accountant or an engineer or a rov or whatever? How do you figure that out? And how do you be who you were designed to who you were intended to be created? Because that's what sacrifice is. Sacrifice is to know the bigger purpose for which I was created and make the sacrifices necessary for that bigger purpose. That's what sacrifice is. That's what korban is. And esh, you've got to take the esh. And yes, aleph shin is the human being. Adam ki yakrid mechem. You've got to sacrifice your physical self to bigger purpose, to higher purpose, to the reason for which the Ribbono Shel Olam put us here. As individuals, not just as a nation. If you read the beginning of Maseiros Yesharim, and he talks about the importance of knowing why you're here, he's talking about the Jewish people. We're here to do the mitzvahs, etc., etc. That's one piece. But there's another piece. What are you here for? What did the Ribbono Shel Olam create you for? What does he expect out of you? What can you do that other people can't do in the different phases of your life? Because it changes. Doesn't mean you're doing the same thing your whole life. At each situation, you've got different assets and you've got different strengths and different talents. And in each situation, Hashem expects you to do something that others can't do. What is that? And how do you work it out? And how do you figure out? And that's a really important process. But in addition to sacrificing yourself, it's also the esh. And the esh is, on the one hand, it's aleph shin, it's the human being, but it's also the energy. That's what esh is. It's the passion and the energy. That also, there's a lot of work being done at the moment, a lot being written, because until recently, there was a lot of emphasis on passion is the differentiator. Steve Jobs was one of the people who pointed that out, where he said, all I need in hiring somebody is somebody who's passionate for Apple. The rest I can teach him. I want somebody who's passionate about Apple. Passion is something that's a requirement. And since then, there's been a lot of talk about the value of passion and how passion differentiates a team, it differentiates a person. That's the differentiator. It's what I call the difference between an A team and a B team. A B team can be exceptionally competent. A B team doesn't mean they're incompetent. B teams, that means they're exceptionally good. But they're not stars. The star is the individual or the team of people or the company that has passion. But now there's been a lot of work being done saying, passion's a bit overrated. Lots of passionate people don't get anything done. Lots of passionate people don't make a contribution. Lots of passionate people are quite self-involved. It's more than that. It's taking your passion and dedicating it to a higher purpose. It's Adam ki yakrid, not only sacrificing, but it's also Eish tukad al hamizbeach. Because, says the old Lubavitcher Rebbe, if you read the Pasuk carefully, Eish tukad al hamizbeach, when you sacrifice your human energy on an altar of higher purpose, loitechabe, not it won't be what, it won't be extinguished, it extinguishes the lo. Lo is the little voice that always tells you what you can't do. Voice of lo is all the inhibitors. Lo are all the forces in the world that distract you and make it hard to get things done. Lo is the power of emotional gravity. Lo is the power of psychological gravity, of economic gravity. All the reasons you say can't do it, impossible, can't be done. When you put esh, tukad al hamizbeach, when you put the fire, your human energy, and you sacrifice it to your higher purpose, then you actually are able to extinguish all those laws, all those negatives, all those inhibitors that hold you back. So when it says lo tevaru esh, we're talking about esh not just as fire, but as human passion and the human power. And when you extinguish that, when you extinguish hope, there's no passion. You need hope for passion. You need optimism for passion. You need to see opportunity for passion. So that you can take that passion and sacrifice it and to something worthwhile and bring it onto a mizbeach, onto an altar of something worthy, of something big, of something purposeful, so that loitechabe, all the inhibitors that work in your mind as to why you can't do things, there is nothing that you can't do if you're aligned with the reason for which you were created. Trying to do things that you weren't created for, that's going to be a little tough. Like I remember, I was a very young guy, and my doctor gave me an examination. He told me, you've got very, very flat feet. So I said, can anything be done about that? He said, no, that's for life. So I said, so what are the implications? What does that mean? He said, it means that you can't join the Royal School of Ballet. And I got into depression because it was the first time I was ever told there's something I can't do. It's not possible. It's actually not possible. And that dealing with that restriction until I got to ask someone, I said, well, at least that tells me one thing. That's not what the devotion expects of me. I'm not here to be a ballerina in case I had any doubts about that. At least I now know that for sure. And that's when I started in some of the thinking, and I was saying, okay, so then each person can work out. Their flat feet mean they're not here to be a ballerina. And there's something else that means they're not here to be an athlete. And something else that's... You can work out by process of elimination and by other processes, some of which I outline in the book, of figuring out what you are here to do. And it's a methodology from the Chovas HaLevavos. The Chovas HaLevavos actually helps one go through process to figure out what are you here to do. Because if you can align with what you're here to do, and you can do it without ego and with sacrifice of self, there's nothing that you can't do in that area. There are no laws. The no's, the inhibitors, get wiped out by Esh Tukada HaMizbeach, by putting your passion onto the Mizbeach. That wipes out any inhibitor that there could possibly be. And that's the avodah, that's the process of working. And in some wonderful conversation that I was able to have with Mr. Welch over Shabbos, we were talking about how sad it is when businesses or rabbonim or mechanchim or anybody lose that passion. Sometimes there's an energy, and we were talking about Johannesburg. And we were talking about the 1970s and 80s, times when Torah started and Osama started and all this. Do you remember the passion and the energy? Do you see it still? Not to the same extent. So what does that mean? Kind of arrived, kind of done that stuff, and now what? We just age and lie down and die? Very dangerous when we lose the Aish. And when there's no Mizbeach, that we're putting this Aish on and really fighting to keep it going and to keep it alive and to find out that higher purpose and to work on the next thing. It's not that you have one purpose throughout your life, and it's not one Mizbeach. Things were brought to the Mizbeach every day, a Korban Tomis in the morning and a grain in the evening and every Yom Tov and every Shabbos. It's an ongoing process to find your Aish and find your Korban and bring it onto the Mizbeach. It's not something you do once and then you wait for it to fizzle out. That's what it is. That's one of the Chiyuvim. That's one of our obligations as human beings, never mind as Jews. To find our Aish, to find that passion, to find our Mizbeach, to find that higher purpose for which we live. And Leitavaira, don't put it out. Don't extinguish it. That Aish is important. That keeps us going. Don't extinguish it on Shabbos. And that's an interesting idea, isn't it? Shabbos is one of the days you think you can let the fire die down a little bit. That's not the rest we're talking about. Shabbos is the time to get excited about your passion. Shabbos is the time you can pull back and you can say, what's my next big idea? Where am I taking my life next? What's my next wave? Where's my next level? Or am I just going to stay here? Shabbos is when you do that. Shabbos, you have a workshop. Shabbos, you vision. Shabbos, you find your purpose. Shabbos, you reconnect with yourself. That's what you do on Shabbos. Don't put it out. Don't extinguish the hope. Attach to the hope. See the vision. Understand the purpose. And refire yourselves up for something that is valuable, something that is big, something that is purposeful, something that has kedusha, something that has sanctity, and that makes a difference to the Ribbono Shel Olam, to the Jewish people, and to the world.
I just want to thank Rabbi Lapin very, very much. And just to say that he kept his promise. He said, I'm not here to entertain, and it wasn't entertainment.
I'm sorry.
It was better than entertainment. It was about being in a virtual casino. He gave us the hope without the cost of being in a casino. So we want to thank you very much, and just everybody's welcome to stay, chat to the Rof, chat to each other, and have some refreshments, and to thank Michelle for all the effort she put in for tonight. And thank you all very much for coming, and a good walk.